Disc 9.
3 days after Buster dropped it off, Ricky's last letter to Al Conyers made it to Chevy Chase. A routine check of Mailbox America by a surveillance team found it. The envelope was examined, then rushed to Langley. Teddy was between briefings, alone for a moment in his office, when DeVille rushed in holding a thin file. "We got this 30 minutes ago," he said as he handed over 3 sheets of paper. "It's a copy. The original is in the file." The director adjusted his bifocals and looked at the copies before he began reading. There was the Jacksonville postmark, same as always. The handwriting was too familiar. He knew it was serious trouble before he began reading. "Dear Al, in your last letter you tried to end our correspondence. Sorry it won't be that easy. I'll get right to the point. I'm not Ricky and you're not Al. I'm in a prison, not some fancy drug rehab clinic. I know who you are, Mr. Lake. I know you're having a great year, just wrapped up the nomination and all, and you have all that money pouring in. They give us newspapers here at Trumbull, and we've been following your success with great pride. Now that I know who Al Conyers really is, I'm sure you'd like for me to keep quiet about our little secret. I'll be happy to remain silent, but it will cost you dearly. I need money, and I want out of prison. I can keep secrets, and I know how to negotiate. The money is the easy part because you have so much of it. My release will be more complicated, but you're collecting all sorts of very powerful friends. I'm sure you'll think of something. I have nothing to lose, and I'm willing to ruin you if you don't negotiate with me. My name is Joe Roy Spicer. I'm an inmate at Trumbull Federal Prison. You figure out a way to contact me, and do it quickly. I will not go away. Sincerely, Joe Roy Spicer." The next briefing was canceled. DeVille found York, and 10 minutes later they were locked away in the bunker. Killing them was the first option discussed. Argro could do it with the right tools, pills and poisons and such. Yarber could die in his sleep. Spicer could drop dead on the track. Beach the hypochondriac could get a bad prescription from the prison pharmacy. They were not particularly fit or healthy, and certainly no match for Argro. A nasty fall, a broken neck. There were many ways to make it look natural or accidental. It would have to be done quickly, while they were still waiting for a reply from Lake. But it would be messy and unduly complicated. 3 dead bodies all at once, in a harmless little prison like Trumbull. And the 3 were close friends, who spent most of their time together, and they would each die in different ways within a very short period of time. It would create an avalanche of suspicion. What if Argro became a suspect? His background was hidden to begin with. And the Trevor factor frightened them. Wherever he was, there was the chance he would hear of their deaths. The news would scare him even more, but it might also make him unpredictable. There was a chance he knew more than they thought. DeVille would work on plans to take them out, but Teddy was very reluctant. He had no qualms about killing the 3, but he was not convinced it would protect Lake. What if the brethren had told someone else? There were too many unknowns. Make the plans, DeVille was told, but they would be used only when every other option was gone. All scenarios were on the table. York suggested, for the sake of argument, that the letter be returned to the box so Lake could find it. It was his screw-up to begin with. "He wouldn't know what to do," Teddy said. "Do we?" "Not yet." The thought of Aaron Lake reacting to this ambush and somehow trying to silence the brethren was almost amusing, but there was a strong element of justice to it. Lake had created this mess. Let him handle it. "Actually, we created this mess," Teddy said, "and we'll deal with it." They couldn't predict, and thus they couldn't control, what Lake would do. Somehow the fool had avoided their net long enough to drop something in the mail to Ricky, and he'd been so stupid that the brethren now knew who he was. Not to mention the obvious, Lake was the type of person who secretly swapped letters with a gay pen pal. He was living a double life and didn't deserve a lot of confidence. Confronting Lake was discussed for a moment. York had been advocating a showdown since the first letter from Trumbull, but Teddy wasn't convinced. The sleep he'd lost fretting over Lake was always filled with thoughts and hopes of stopping the mail long before now. Quietly take care of the problem, then have a chat with the candidate. Oh, how he'd love to confront Lake. He'd love to sit him in a chair over there and start flashing copies of all those damned letters up on a screen, and a copy of the ad from Out and About. He'd tell him about Mr. Quince Garby in Bakers, Iowa, another idiot who fell for the scam, and Curtis Van Gates in Dallas. How could you be so stupid? He wanted to scream at Aaron Lake. But Teddy kept his eye on the bigger picture. The problems with Lake were small when compared to the urgency of national defense. The Russians were coming, and when Natychenkov and the new regime seized power, the world would change forever. Teddy had neutralized men far more powerful than three felonious judges rotting away in a federal prison. Meticulous planning was his strong suit. Patient, tedious planning. The meeting was interrupted by a message from DeVille's office. Trevor Carson's passport had been scanned at a departure checkpoint at the airport in Hamilton, Bermuda. He left on a flight to San Juan, Puerto Rico, that was scheduled to land in about 50 minutes. Did we know he was in Bermuda? York asked. No, we did not, DeVille answered. Evidently, he entered without using his passport. Maybe he's not as drunk as we thought. Do we have someone in Puerto Rico? Teddy asked, his voice only a shade more excited. Of course, said York. Let's pick up the scent. Have the plans changed for old Trevor? DeVille asked. No, not at all, Teddy said. Not at all. DeVille left to deal with the latest Trevor crisis. Teddy called an assistant and ordered mint tea. York was reading the letter again. When they were alone, he asked, What if we separate them? Yes, I was thinking of that. Do it quickly before they have time to confer. Send them to three prisons far apart, put them in isolation for a period of time, make sure they have no phone privileges, no mail. Then what? They still have their secret. Any one of them could conceivably ruin Lake. I'm not sure we have the contacts within the Bureau of Prisons. It can be done. If necessary, I'll have a chat with the Attorney General. Since when did you become friends with the Attorney General? It's a matter of national security. Three crooked judges sitting in a federal prison in Florida can somehow affect national security? I'd like to hear that conversation. Teddy sipped his tea with his eyes closed, all 10 fingers on the cup. It's too risky, he whispered. We make them mad, they become even more erratic. We can't take chances here. Suppose Argro can find their records, York said. Think about it, these are con men, convicted criminals. No one will believe their story about Lake unless they have proof. The proof is documentation, pieces of paper, originals, and copies of the correspondence. The proof exists somewhere. We find it, take it from them, then who will listen? Another small sip, with his eyes closed, another long pause. Teddy shifted slightly in his chair and grimaced from the pain. True, he said softly. But I'm worried about somebody on the outside, somebody we know nothing about. These guys are a step ahead of us, and they always will be. We're trying to figure out what they've known for some time. I'm not sure we'll ever catch up. Maybe they've thought about losing their little files. I'm sure the prison has rules against maintaining such paperwork, so they're already hiding things. The Lake letters are much too valuable not to copy again and stash on the outside. Trevor was their mailman. We've seen every letter he's carried out of Trumbull for the past month. We think we have, but we don't know for certain. But who? Spicer has a wife. She's been to see him. Yarber is getting a divorce, but who knows what they're doing? She's visited in the past 3 months. Or maybe they're bribing guards to run mail for them. These people are bored, and they're smart, and they're very creative. We can't just assume we know everything they're up to. And if we make a mistake here, if we assume too much, And Mr. Aaron Lake gets himself shoved out of the closet. How? How would they do it? Probably contact a reporter, feed him one letter at a time until he was convinced it would work. The press would go insane. It can't happen, York. We simply cannot allow it to happen. DeVille returned in a rush. U.S. Customs had been notified by the authorities in Bermuda 10 minutes after the flight departed for San Juan. Trevor would be landing in 18 minutes. Trevor was just following his money. He had quickly grasped the fundamentals of wire transfers and was now perfecting the art. In Bermuda, he had sent half of it to a bank in Switzerland and the other half to a bank in Grand Cayman. East or west? That had been the great question. The quickest flight out of Bermuda went to London, but the idea of sneaking through Heathrow scared him. He was not a wanted man, at least not by the government. No charges were filed or pending, but the Brits were so efficient at customs. He'd go west and take his chances in the Caribbean. He landed in San Juan and went straight to a bar where he ordered a tall draft and studied the flights. No hurry, no pressure, a pocket full of cash. He could go anywhere, do anything, and take as long as he wanted. He had another draft and decided to spend a few days in Grand Cayman with his money. He went to the Air Jamaica counter and bought a ticket, then back to the bar because it was almost 5 and he had 30 minutes before boarding. Of course, he flew first class. He boarded early so he could get another drink, and as he watched the other passengers file by, he saw a face he'd seen before. Where was it now? Just moments ago, somewhere in the airport. A long, thin face with a salt-and-pepper goatee and little narrow slits for eyes behind square glasses. The eyes glanced at him just long enough to meet Trevor's, then looked away down the aisle, as if nothing had been seen. It had been near the airline counter, as Trevor was turning to leave after buying his ticket. The face was watching him. The man was standing nearby, studying the departure notices. When you're on the run, the stray glances and second looks and drifting eyes all seem more suspicious. See a face once, and you don't even know it. See it again a half hour later, and somebody is watching every move you make. Stop drinking, Trevor ordered himself. He asked for coffee after takeoff and drank it quickly. He was the first passenger off the plane in Kingston, and he walked quickly through the terminal through immigration. No sign of the man behind him. He grabbed his two small bags and raced for the taxi stand. Chapter 32. The Jacksonville paper arrived at Trumbull each morning around 7. 4 copies were taken to the game room, where they were to be read and left behind for any of the inmates who cared about life on the outside. Most of the time, Joe Roy Spicer was the only one waiting at 7, and he usually took one paper for himself because he needed to study the Vegas lines throughout the day. The scene rarely changed. Spicer, with a tall styrofoam cup of coffee, feet on a card table, waiting for Roderick the guard to bring the papers. So Spicer saw the story first, at the bottom of the front page. Trevor Carson, a local lawyer who'd been missing for some vague reason, found dead outside a hotel in Kingston, Jamaica, shot twice in the head last night, just after dark. The story had no picture of Trevor, Spicer noticed. Why would the paper have one on file? Why would anyone care if Trevor died? According to Jamaican officials, Carson was a tourist who'd apparently been robbed. An unidentified source close to the scene had tipped the police as to the identity of Mr. Carson, since his wallet was missing. The source seemed to know a lot. The paragraph recapping Trevor's legal career was quite brief. A former secretary, Jan something or other, had no comment. The story had been thrown together and placed on the front page only because the victim was a murdered lawyer. Finn was at the far end of the track, rounding the turn, walking at a rapid clip in the damp early morning air, his shirt already off. Spicer waited at the home stretch and handed him the paper without a word. They found Beach waiting in line in the cafeteria, holding his plastic tray and staring forlornly at the crude piles of freshly scrambled eggs. They sat together in a corner, away from everyone else, picking at their food, talking in muted voices. If he was running, who the hell was he running from? Maybe Lake was after him. He didn't know it was Lake. He didn't have a clue, did he? Okay, then he was running from Conyers. The last time he was here, he said Conyers was the big one. He said Conyers knew about us, then he disappeared the next day. Maybe he's just scared. Conyers confronted him, threatened to expose his role in our scam, and so Trevor, who wasn't the most stable guy to begin with, decided to steal all he could and disappear. Whose money was missing? That's what I want to know. Nobody knows about our money. How could it be missing? Trevor probably stole from everybody he could, then vanished. Happens all the time. Lawyers get in trouble, crack up, they raid their clients' trust funds, and bolt. Really? Asked Spicer. Beach could think of three examples, and Yarber added a couple more for good measure. So who killed him? There's a good chance he was just in the wrong part of town. Outside a Sheraton hotel? I don't think so. Okay, what if Conyers iced him? That's possible. Conyers somehow smoked out Trevor, learned he was the outside contact for Ricky. He put pressure on Trevor, threatened to nail him or whatever, and Trevor ran off to the Caribbean. Trevor didn't know Conyers was Aaron Lake. And Lake certainly has the money and power to track down a drunken lawyer. What about us? By now, Lake knows Ricky ain't Ricky, that Joe Roy here is the man, and that he has friends with him in prison. Question is, can he get to us? I guess I'll find out first, Spicer said with a nervous laugh. And there's always the chance that Trevor was down there in Jamaica, hanging around in the wrong part of town, probably drunk and trying to pick up a woman, and he got himself shot. They all agreed on this, that Trevor was perfectly capable of getting himself killed. May he rest in peace, but only if he didn't steal their money. They scattered for an hour or so. Beach went to the track to walk and think. Yarber was on the clock, 20 cents an hour, trying to fix a computer in the chaplain's office. Spicer went to the library, where he found Mr. Argro reading law books. The law library was open, no appointments were necessary, but the unwritten rule was that you should at least ask one of the brethren before using their books. Argro was new and obviously had not yet learned the rules. Spicer decided to give him a break. They acknowledged each other with a nod, then Spicer got busy clearing tables and straightening books. "Rumor has it you guys do legal work," Argro said from across the room. No one else was present. "You hear a lot of rumors around here. My case is on appeal." "What happened at trial?" "Jury nailed me on 3 counts of bank fraud, hiding money offshore in the Bahamas. The judge gave me 60 months. I've served 4. I'm not sure I'm going to last for 56 more. I need some help with my appeals."
"What caught?"
"Virgin Islands. I worked for a big bank in Miami, lots of drug money."
"So you're a banker?"
Argro was glib and fast and very anxious to talk, and this irritated Spicer, but only slightly. The reference to the Bahamas had his attention. "I was. For some reason, I developed a fascination for money laundering. I dealt with tens of millions every day, and it was intoxicating. I could move dirty money quicker than any banker in South Florida, still can. But I made some bad friends and bad choices."
"You admit you're guilty?"
"Sure."
"That puts you in the distinct minority around here."
"No, I was wrong, but I think the sentence was too harsh. Somebody said you guys can get some time knocked off." Spicer was no longer concerned with the untidy tables and disorganized books. He took a chair nearby and had time to talk.
"We can take a look at your papers," he said, as if he'd handled 1,000 appeals.
"You idiot," Argro wanted to say. "You dropped out of high school in the 10th grade and stole a car when you were 19. Your father pulled some strings and got the charges dropped. You got yourself elected Justice of the Peace by voting dead people and stuffing absentee ballots, and now you're stuck in a federal pen and trying to play the big shot." "And," Argro conceded, "you, Mr. Spicer, now have the power to bring down the next president of the United States." What will it cost? Agro asked.
How much do you have?
Spicer asked, just like a real lawyer. Not much.
I thought you knew how to hide money offshore.
Oh, I do, believe me. And at one point I had a nice bundle, but I let it get away.
So you can't pay anything?
Not much, maybe a couple thousand or so.
What about your lawyer?
He got me convicted. I don't have enough to hire a new one. Spicer pondered the situation for a moment. He realized he did indeed miss Trevor. Things had been much simpler when they had him on the outside, collecting money.
You still got contacts in the Bahamas?
I have contacts all over the Caribbean. Why?
Because you'll have to wire the money. Cash is forbidden around here.
You want me to wire $2,000?
No, I want you to wire $5,000. That's our minimum fee.
Where's your bank?
In the Bahamas.
Argro's eyes narrowed. His eyebrows pushed together, and while he was deep in thought, so was Spicer. The minds were in the process of meeting.
Why the Bahamas? Argro asked.
Same reason you use the Bahamas.
Thoughts rattled around in both heads.
Let me ask you something, Spicer said. You said you could move dirty money quicker than anybody else.
Argro nodded and said, no problem.
Can you still do it?
You mean from in here?
Yes, from here.
Argro laughed and shrugged as if nothing could be easier. Sure, I still have some friends.
Meet me here in an hour. I might have a deal for you.
An hour later, Argro returned to the law library and found the three judges already in position, behind a table with papers and law books scattered about as if the Supreme Court of Florida were in session. Spicer introduced him to Mr. Beach and Mr. Yarber, and he took a seat across the table. No one else was present. They talked for a moment about his appeal, and he was sufficiently vague on the details. His file was en route from the other prison, and they couldn't do much without it. The appeal was a preliminary topic of conversation, and both sides of the table knew it.
Mr. Spicer tells us you're an expert on moving dirty money, Beach said.
I was until I got caught, Argro said modestly. I take it you have some.
We have a little account offshore, money we've earned doing legal work, and a few other things we can't be too open about. As you know, we can't charge for legal work.
But we do anyway, added Yarber, and we get paid for it.
How much is in the account? Argro asked, knowing yesterday's closing balance to the exact penny.
Let's wait on that, Spicer said. There's a good chance the money may have disappeared.
Argro let the words hang for a second and managed to appear confused. I'm sorry, he said.
We had a lawyer, Beach said slowly, each word measured. He disappeared, and he may have taken the money.
I see. And this account is in a bank in the Bahamas?
It was. We're not sure if it still is.
We doubt the money is still there, Yarber added.
But we'd like to know for sure, Beach added.
Which bank? Argro asked.
Geneva Trust in Nassau, Spicer answered, glancing at his colleagues.
Argro nodded smugly, as if he knew dark little dirty secrets about the bank.
You know the bank? Beach asked.
Sure, he said, and let them hang for a long second.
And? Spicer said.
Argro was overcome with smugness and insider knowledge, so he stood rather dramatically and walked around the small library for a moment, deep in thought, then moved closer to the table again. Look, what do you guys want me to do? Let's cut to the chase. The three looked at him, then at each other, and it was obvious they weren't sure of two things. A, how much they trusted this man they'd just met, and B, what they really wanted from him. But they figured the money was gone anyway, so what was there to lose? Yarber said,
"We're not too sophisticated when it comes to moving dirty money. That was not our original calling, you understand. Forgive our lack of knowledge, but
Is there any way to verify if the money is still where it once was?
We're just not sure if the lawyer stole it, Beach added.
You want me to verify the balance of a secret account? Argro asked.
Yes, that's it, said Yarber.
We figure that maybe you still have some friends in the business, Spicer said, treading water, and we're just curious as to whether there's any way to do this.
You're lucky, Argro said, and allowed the words to settle.
How's that? Beach asked.
You picked the Bahamas.
Actually, the lawyer picked the Bahamas, Spicer said.
Anyway, the banks are pretty loose there. Lots of secrets get told. Lots of officials get bribed. Most of the serious money launderers stay away from the Bahamas. Panama is the current hotspot, and of course Grand Cayman is still rock solid.
Of course, they all three nodded. Offshore was offshore, wasn't it? Just another example of trusting an idiot like Trevor.
Argro watched them with their puzzled faces and thought how truly clueless they were. For three men with the ability to totally wreck the American electoral process, they seemed awfully naive.
You haven't answered our question, Spicer said.
Anything's possible in the Bahamas.
So you can do it.
I can try, no guarantees.
Here's the deal, Spicer said. You verify the account, and we'll do your appeals for free.
That's not a bad deal, Argro said.
We didn't think so. Agreed?
Agreed. For an awkward second, they just looked at one another, proud of their mutual agreement, but not sure who moved next. Finally, Argro said, I'll need to know something about the account.
Such as? Beach asked.
Such as a name or a number.
The account name is Boomer Realty Limited. The account number is 144DXN9593.
Argro scribbled some notes on a sheet of scrap paper.
Just curious, Spicer said as they watched him closely. How do you plan to communicate with your contacts outside?
Phone, Argro said without looking up.
Not these phones, Beach said.
These phones are not secure, Yarber said.
You can't use these phones, Spicer said with an edge.
Argro smiled and acknowledged their concerns. Then he glanced over his shoulder and removed from his pants pocket an instrument of some sort, not much larger than a pocket knife. He held it between his thumb and index finger and said, This is a phone, gentlemen. They stared in disbelief, then watched as he quickly unfolded it from the top and the bottom and from one side, so that when properly opened it still looked much too small for any meaningful conversation.
It's digital, he said. Very secure. Who gets the monthly bill? Asked Beach.
I have a brother in Boca Raton. The phone and the service were gifts from him. He snapped it back smartly and it vanished before their eyes. Then he pointed to the small conference room behind them to their chamber. What's in there? He asked.
Just a conference room, Spicer said.
It has no windows, right?
None, except for that small one in the door.
All right. What if I go in there, get on the phone, and go to work? You three stay here and watch out for me. If anyone enters the library, come knock on the door. The brethren readily agreed, though they did not believe Argro could pull it off. The call went to the white van, parked a mile and a half from Trumbull, on a gravel road sometimes maintained by the county. The road was next to a hayfield farmed by a man they'd yet to meet. The property line for the acreage owned by the federal government was a quarter of a mile away, but from where the van was sitting there was no sign of a prison. Only two technicians were in the van, one fully asleep in the front seat, the other half asleep in the back with a headset on. When Argro pressed the send button on his fancy little gadget, a receiver in the van was activated and both men came to life.
Hello, he said. This is Argro.
Yes, Argro, Chevy One here, go ahead, said the technician in the back.
I'm near the Three Stooges, going through the motions, supposedly making calls to friends on the outside to verify the existence of their account offshore. So far, things are progressing even faster than I'd hoped.
Sounds like it.
Roger. I'll check in later. He pushed the end button, but kept the phone at his head and appeared to be deep in conversation. He sat on the edge of the table, then he walked around some, glancing occasionally at the brethren and beyond. Spicer couldn't help but sneak a look through the window of the door. "He's making calls," he said excitedly. "What do you expect him to be doing?" asked Yarber, who was actually reading recent court decisions. "Relax, Joe Roy," Beach said. "The money disappeared with Trevor." 20 minutes passed, and things became dull as usual. While Argro worked the phones, the judges killed time, waiting at first, then returning to more pressing business. It had been 6 days since Buster had left with their letter. No word from Buster meant he'd walked away clean, dropped off the note to Mr. Conyers, and was now somewhere far away. Give it 3 days to travel to Chevy Chase, and the way they had it figured, Mr. Aaron Lake should now be scrambling with a plan to deal with them. Prison had taught them patience. Only one deadline worried them. Lake had the nomination, which meant he would be vulnerable to their blackmail until November. If he won, they would have 4 years in which to torment him. But if he lost, he would fade quickly away, like all the losers. "Where's Dukakis now?" Beach had asked. They had no plans to wait until November. Patience was one thing, release was another. Lake was their one fleeting opportunity to walk away with enough money to coast forever. They intended to give it a week, then write another letter to Mr. Al Conyers and Chevy Chase. They weren't sure how to smuggle it out, but they would think of something. Link, the guard up front, whom Trevor had been bribing for months, was their first prospect. Argro's phone presented an option. "If he'll let us use it," Spicer said, "then we can call Lake, call his campaign office, his congressional office, call every damn number we can get from directory assistance. Leave the message that Ricky in rehab really needs to see Mr. Lake. That'll scare the hell out of him." "But Argro will have a record of our calls, or at least his brother will," Yarber said. "So? We'll pay him for the calls. And so what if they know we're trying to call Aaron Lake? Right now half the country is trying to call him. Argro won't have a clue why we're doing it." A brilliant idea, one they pondered for a long time. Ricky in rehab could make the calls and leave the messages. Spicer in Trumbull could do the same. Poor Lake would get hounded. Poor Lake. The man had money pouring in so fast he couldn't count it. After an hour, Argro emerged from the chamber and announced he was making progress. "I need to wait an hour, then make a few more calls," he said. "What about lunch?" They were anxious to continue their discussion, and they did so over Sloppy Joe's and coleslaw. Chapter 33. Pursuant to Mr. Lake's precise instructions, Jane drove alone to Chevy Chase. She found the shopping center on Western Avenue and parked in front of Mailbox America. With Mr. Lake's key, she opened the box, removed 8 pieces of junk mail, and placed them in a folder. There were no personal letters. She walked to the counter and informed the clerk that she wished to close the box on behalf of her employer, Mr. Al Conyers. The clerk pecked a few times on a keyboard. The records indicated that a man named Aaron L. Lake had rented the box in the name of Al Conyers about 7 months earlier. The rental had been paid for 12 months, so nothing was owed. "That guy running for president?" the clerk asked as she slid a form across the counter. "Yes," Jane said, signing where indicated. "No forwarding address?" "No." She left with the folder and headed south back into the city. She had not stopped to question Lake's story about renting the box in a clandestine effort to expose fraud at the Pentagon. It didn't matter to her, nor did she have time to ask a lot of questions. Lake had them sprinting 18 hours a day, and she had far more important things to worry about. He was waiting in his campaign office, alone for the moment. The offices and hallways around him were choked with assistants of a dozen varieties, all running back and forth as if war was imminent. But Lake was enjoying a lull in the action. She gave him the folder and left. Lake counted 8 pieces of junk mail, Taco delivery, long-distance service, a car wash, coupons for this and for that. And nothing from Ricky. The box was closed. There was no forwarding address. The poor boy would have to find someone else to help him through his new life. Lake fed the junk mail and the cancellation agreement through a small shredder under his desk and paused a moment to count his blessings. He carried little baggage in life, and he'd made few mistakes. Writing to Ricky had been a stupid thing to do, yet he was walking away unscathed. What a lucky man. He smiled and almost giggled to himself. Then he bounced from his chair, grabbed his jacket, and rounded up his entourage. The candidate had meetings to attend, then a lunch with defense contractors. Oh, what a lucky man. Back in the corner of the law library, with his three new friends guarding the perimeter like sleepy sentries, Argro fiddled with the phone long enough to convince them he'd pulled strings all through the dark and murky world of offshore banking. 2 hours of pacing and mumbling and holding the phone to his head like a frantic stockbroker, and he finally came out of the room. "Good news, gentlemen," he said with a tired smile. They huddled around, eager for the results. "It's still there," he said. Then the great question, the one they'd been planning, the one that would verify whether Argro was a fraud or a player. "How much?" asked Spicer. $190,000 and small change," he said, and they exhaled in unison. Spicer smiled. Beach looked away. Yarber looked at Argro with a quizzical frown, but a rather pleasant one. According to their figures, the balance was $189,000 plus whatever paltry rate of interest the bank was paying. "He didn't steal it," Beach mumbled, and they shared a pleasant memory of their dead lawyer, who suddenly was not the devil they'd made him out to be. "I wonder why not," Spicer mused almost to himself. "Well, it's still there," Argro said. "That's a lot of legal work." It certainly appeared to be, and since neither of the three could think of a quick fib, they just let it pass. "I suggest you move it, if you don't mind my saying so," Argro said. "This bank is known for its leaks." "Move it where?" Beach asked. "If the money were mine, I'd move it to Panama immediately." This was a new issue, a train of thought they had not pursued because they had been obsessed with Trevor and his certain theft. But they weighed it carefully anyway, as if the matter had been discussed many times. "Why would you move it?" Beach asked. "It's safe, isn't it?" "I guess," Argro answered, quick with a response. He knew where he was going. They did not. "But you see how loose the confidentiality can be. I wouldn't use banks in the Bahamas these days, especially this one." "And we don't know if Trevor told anyone about it," Spicer said, always anxious to nail the lawyer. "If you want the money protected, move it," Argro said. "It takes less than a day and you won't have to worry about it. And put the money to work. This account is just sitting there, drawing a few pennies in interest. Put it with a fund manager and let it earn 15 or 20%. You're not going to be using it anytime soon." "That's what you think, pal," they thought. But he made perfect sense. "And I assume you can move it?" Yarber said. "Of course I can. Do you doubt me now?" All three shook their heads. No, sir, they did not doubt him. "I have some nice contacts in Panama. Think about it." Argro glanced at his watch as if he had lost interest in their account and had 100 pressing matters elsewhere. A punchline was coming, and he didn't want to push. "We've thought about it," Spicer said. "Let's move it now." He looked at three sets of eyes, all looking back at him. "There's a fee involved," he said, like a seasoned money launderer. "What kind of fee?" Spicer asked. 10% for the transfer. "Who gets 10%?
"I do."
"That's rather steep," said Beach. "It's a sliding scale. Anything under $1 million pays 10%. Anything over $100 million pays 1%. It's pretty common in the business, and it's exactly the reason I'm wearing an olive prison shirt and not a $1,000 suit.
"That's pretty sleazy,"
said Spicer, the man who'd skimmed bingo profits from a charity.
Let's not preach, okay? We're talking about a small cut from money that's already tainted, both here and there. Take it or leave it.
His tone was aloof, an icy veteran who'd cut much larger deals.
It was only $19,000, and this from a stash they'd been certain was gone. After his 10%, they still had $170,000, roughly $60,000 each. And it would have been more if treacherous Trevor hadn't raked so much off the top. And besides, they were confident of greener pastures just around the corner. The loot in the Bahamas was pocket change.
It's a deal, Spicer said as he looked at the other two for approval. They both nodded slowly. All three were thinking the same thing now. If the shakedown of Aaron Lake proceeded as they dreamed it would, then serious money was coming their way. They would need a place to hide it, and maybe someone to help them. They wanted to trust this new guy, Argro. Let's give him the chance.
Plus, you do my appeals, Argro said.
Yes, we'll do the appeals.
Argro smiled and said, not a bad deal. Let me make some more calls.
There's one thing you should know, Beach said.
Okay.
The lawyer's name was Trevor Carson. He set up the account, directed the deposits, did everything, really. And he was murdered night before last in Kingston, Jamaica.
Argro searched their faces for more. Yarber handed him a copy of the newspaper, which he read very deliberately.
Why was he missing? He asked after a long silence.
We don't know, Beach said. He left town, and we got word through the FBI that he was missing. We just assumed that he'd stolen our money.
Argro handed the paper back to Yarber and crossed his arms over his chest. He cocked his head, narrowed his eyes, and managed to look suspicious. Let them sweat. How dirty is this money? He asked, as if he might not want to get involved with it after all.
It's not drug money. Spicer said quickly, on the defensive, as if all other money was clean.
We really can't say, Beach replied.
You've got a deal, Yarber said. Take it or leave it.
Good move, old boy, Argro said to himself.
The FBI is involved? He asked.
Only with the lawyer's disappearance, Beach said. The feds know nothing about the offshore account.
Let me get this straight. You got a dead lawyer, the FBI, an offshore account hiding dirty money, right? What have you boys been up to?
You don't want to know, Beach said.
I think you're right.
No one's forcing you to get involved, Yarber said.
So a decision had to be made. For Argro, the red flags were up. The minefield was marked. If he went forward, then he did so armed with sufficient warnings that his three new friends could be dangerous. This, of course, meant nothing to Argro, but to Beach, Spicer, and Yarber, the opening in their tight little partnership, however slight it might be, meant they were admitting another conspirator. They would never tell him about their scam, and certainly not about Aaron Lake, nor would he share in any more of their loot, unless he earned it with his wiring prowess. But he already knew more than he should. They had no choice. Desperation played no small role in their decision. With Trevor, they'd had access to the outside, something they'd taken for granted. Now that he was gone, their world had shrunk considerably. Though they had yet to admit it, firing him had been a mistake. With perfect hindsight, they should have warned him and told him everything about Lake and the tampered mail. He'd been far from perfect, but they needed all the help they could get. Perhaps they would have hired him back a day or two later, but they never had the chance. Trevor bolted, and now he was gone forever. Argro had access. He had a phone and friends. He had guts, and he knew how to get things done. Perhaps they might need him, but they would take it slowly. He scratched his head and frowned as if a headache was coming. Don't tell me anything else, he said. I don't want to know.
He returned to the conference room and closed the door behind him, then perched on the edge of the table and once again seemed to be firing calls all over the Caribbean. They heard him laugh twice, probably a joke with an old friend surprised to hear his voice. They heard him swear once, but had no idea at whom or for what reason. His voice rose and fell, and try as they might to read court decisions and dust off old books and study Vegas odds, they couldn't ignore the noise from the room. Argro put on quite a show, and after an hour of useless chatter, he came out and said, "I think I can finish it tomorrow, but we need an affidavit signed by one of you stating that you are the sole owners of Boomer Realty." "Who sees the affidavit?" Beach asked. "Only the bank in the Bahamas. They're getting a copy of the story about Mr. Carson, and they want verification about the ownership of the account." The idea of actually signing any type of document in which they admitted they had anything to do with the dirty money terrified them. But the request made sense. "Is there a fax machine around here?" Argro asked. "No, not for us," Beach replied. "I'm sure the warden has one," Spicer said. "Just trot up there and tell him you need to send a document to your offshore bank." It was unnecessarily sarcastic. Argro glared at him, then let it pass. "Okay. Tell me how to get the affidavit from here to the Bahamas. How does the mail run?" "The lawyer was our mail runner," Yarber said. "Everything else is subject to inspection." "How close do they inspect the legal mail?" "They glance at it," Spicer said, "but they can't open it." Argro paced around a bit, deep in thought. Then, for the benefit of his audience, he stepped between two racks of books so that he could not be seen from outside the law library. He deftly unfolded his gadget, punched numbers, and stuck it to his ear. He said, "Yes, Wilson Argro here, is Jack in?"
"Yes. Tell him it's important."
He waited.
"Who the hell's Jack?" Spicer asked from across the room.
Beach and Yarber listened but watched for passers-by.
"My brother in Boca," Argro said. "He's a real estate lawyer. He's visiting me tomorrow."
Then into the phone he said, "Hey, Jack, it's me. You coming tomorrow?"
"Good. Can you come in the morning?"
"Good. Around 10. I'll have some mail going out."
"Good. How's Mom?"
"Good.
I'll see you in the morning."
The prospect of the resumption of mail intrigued the brethren. Argro had a brother who was a lawyer, and he had a phone and brains and guts. He slid the gadget back into his pocket and walked from the racks.
"I'll give the affidavit to my brother in the morning. He'll fax it to the bank. By noon the next day, the money will be in Panama, safe and sound, and earning 15%. Piece of cake."
"We're assuming we can trust your brother," Yarber said.
"With your life," Argro said, almost offended by the question. He was walking to the door.
"I'll see you guys later. I need some fresh air."
Chapter 34 Trevor's mother arrived from Scranton. She was with her sister, Trevor's Aunt Helen. They were both in their 70s and in reasonably good health. They got lost 4 times between the airport and Neptune Beach, then meandered through the streets for an hour before stumbling on Trevor's house, a place his mother hadn't seen in 6 years. She hadn't seen Trevor in 2 years. Aunt Helen hadn't seen him in at least 10, not that she particularly missed him. His mother parked the rental car behind his little Beetle and had a good cry before getting out.
"What a dump," Aunt Helen said to herself.
The front door was unlocked. The place had been abandoned, but long before its owner fled, the dishes had collected in the sink, the garbage had gone unattended, the vacuum hadn't left the closet. The odor drove Aunt Helen out first, and Trevor's mother soon followed. They had no clue what to do. His body was still in Jamaica in a crowded morgue, and according to the unfriendly young man she'd talked to at the State Department, it would cost $600 to ship him home. The airlines would cooperate, but the paperwork was tied up in Kingston. It took a half hour of bad driving to find his office. By then, word was out. Chap, the paralegal, was waiting at the reception desk, trying to look sad and busy at the same time. Wes, the office manager, was in a back room just to listen and observe. The phone had rung constantly the day the news broke, but after a round of condolences from fellow lawyers and a client or two, it went silent again. On the front door was a cheap wreath, paid for by the CIA. "Ain't that nice?" his mother said as they waddled up the sidewalk. "Another dump," thought Aunt Helen. Chap greeted them and introduced himself as Trevor's paralegal. He was in the process of trying to close the office, a most difficult task. "Where's the girl?" his mother asked, her eyes red from grieving. "She left some time back. Trevor caught her stealing." "Oh, dear." "Would you like some coffee?" he asked.
"That would be nice, yes."
They sat on the dusty and uneven sofa while Chap fetched three coffees from a pot that just happened to be fresh. He sat across from them in an unstable wicker chair. The mother was bewildered. The aunt was curious, her eyes darting around the office, looking for any sign of prosperity. They were not poor, but at their ages, affluence would never be attained.
"I'm very sorry about Trevor," Chap said.
"It's just awful," Mrs. Carson said, her lip quivering.
Her cup shook and coffee splashed onto her dress. She didn't notice it.
"Did he have a lot of clients?" Aunt Helen asked.
"Yes, he was very busy. A good lawyer, one of the best I've ever worked with."
"And you're a secretary?" Mrs. Carson asked.
"No, I'm a paralegal. I go to law school at night."
"Are you handling his affairs?" Aunt Helen asked.
"Well, not really," Chap said. "I was hoping that's why the two of you are here."
"Oh, we're too old," his mother said.
"How much money did he leave?" asked the aunt.
Chap stepped it up a notch. This old bitch was a bloodhound.
"I have no idea. I didn't handle his money."
"Who did?"
"I guess his accountant."
"Who's his accountant?"
"I don't know. Trevor was very private about most things."
"He certainly was," his mother said sadly. "Even as a boy."
She splashed her coffee again, this time on the sofa.
"You pay the bills around here, don't you?" asked the aunt.
"No, Trevor took care of his money."
"Well, listen, young man, they want $600 to fly him home from down in Jamaica."
"Why was he down there?" his mother interrupted.
"It was a short vacation," Chap said.
"And she doesn't have $600, Helen finished.
"Yes, I do."
"Oh, there's some cash here," Chap said, and Aunt Helen looked satisfied.
"How much?" she asked.
"A little over $900. Trevor liked to keep plenty of petty cash."
"Give it to me," Aunt Helen demanded.
"Do you think we should?"
asked his mother.
"You'd better take it," Chap said gravely. "If not, it will just go into his estate, and the IRS will get it all."
"What else will go into his estate?" asked the aunt.
"All this," Chap said, waving his arms at the office while he walked to the desk. He removed a wrinkled envelope stuffed with bills of all denominations, money they'd just transferred from the rental across the street. He gave it to Helen, who snatched it and counted the money.
$920 and some change," Chap said.
"Which bank did he use?" Helen asked.
"I have no idea. Like I said, he was very private about his money."
And in one respect, Chap was telling the truth. Trevor had wired the $900,000 from the Bahamas to Bermuda, and from there the trail had disappeared. The money was now hidden in a bank somewhere in a numbered account accessible only by Trevor Carson. They knew he was headed for Grand Cayman, but the bankers there were famous for their secrecy. 2 days of intense digging had revealed nothing. The man who shot him took his wallet and room key, and while the police were inspecting the crime scene, the gunman searched the hotel room. There was about $8,000 in cash hidden in a drawer and nothing else of any significance. Not a clue as to where Trevor had parked his money. It was the collected wisdom at Langley that Trevor, for some reason, suspected he was being followed closely. The bulk of the cash was missing, though he could have deposited it in a bank in Bermuda. His hotel room had been secured without a reservation. He simply walked in from the street and paid cash for one night. A person on the run chasing $900,000 from one island to the next would have somewhere on his body or in his effects evidence of banking activities. Trevor had none. While Aunt Helen riffled through what would surely be the only cash they'd net from the estate, Wes thought about the fortune lost somewhere in the Caribbean.
"What do we do now?" Trevor's mother asked.
Chap shrugged and said, "I guess you need to bury him."
"Can you help us?"
"That's not really something I do."
"Should we take him back to Scranton?" Helen asked.
"That's up to you."
"How much would that cost?" Helen asked.
"I have no idea. I've never had to do anything like this."
"But all his friends are here," his mother said, touching her eyes with a tissue.
"He left Scranton a long time ago," Helen said,
her eyes cutting in all directions, as if there was a long story behind Trevor's leaving Scranton. "No doubt," thought Chap.
"I'm sure his friends here will want a memorial service," Mrs. Carson said.
"Actually, one is already planned," Chap said.
"It is," she said, thrilled.
"Yes, it's tomorrow at 4 o'clock.
"Where?"
"A place called Pete's, just down the street a few blocks."
"Pete's?"
Helen said.
It's
sort of a restaurant."
"A restaurant? What about a church?"
"I don't think he went."
"He did when he was a boy," his mother said in defense.
In memory of Trevor, the 5 o'clock happy hour would begin at 4 and run until midnight. 50-cent longnecks, Trevor's favorite.
"Should we go?" asked Helen, sensing trouble.
"I wouldn't think so."
"Why not?"
asked Mrs. Carson. "It could be a rough crowd. A bunch of lawyers and judges. You know the scene." He frowned at Helen, and she got the message. They asked about funeral parlors and cemetery lots, and Chap felt himself getting dragged deeper and deeper into their problems. The CIA killed Trevor. Was it expected to send him off with a proper burial? Klockner thought not. After the ladies left, Wes and Chap finished the removal of the cameras, wires, mics, and phone taps. They tidied up the place, and when they locked the doors for the last time, Trevor's office had never been so orderly. Half of Klockner's team had already left town. The other half monitored Wilson Argro inside Trumbull. And they waited. When the forgers at Langley finished with Argro's court file, it fit in a cardboard box and was flown to Jacksonville on a small jet, along with 3 agents. It contained, among many other things, a 51-page indictment handed down by a grand jury in Dade County, a correspondence file filled with letters from Argro's defense lawyer and the U.S. Attorney's Office, a thick file of motions and other pre-trial maneuverings, research memos, a list of witnesses and summaries of their testimonies, a trial brief, jury analysis, an abstract of the trial, pre-sentencing reports, and the final sentence itself. It was reasonably well organized, though not too neat to arouse suspicion. Copies were smudged, and pages were missing, and staples were hanging off, little touches of reality carefully added by the good folks in documents to create authenticity. 90% of it would not be needed by Beach and Yarber, but its sheer heft made it impressive. Even the cardboard box had some age on it. The box was delivered to Trumbull by Jack Argro, a semi-retired real estate lawyer in Boca Raton, Florida, and brother of the inmate. Lawyer Argro's state bar certification had been faxed to the proper bureaucrat at Trumbull, and his name was on the approved list of attorneys. Jack Argro was Roger Leiter, a 13-year man with a law degree from Texas. He'd never met Kenny Sands, who was Wilson Argro. The two shook hands and said hello, while Link looked suspiciously at the cardboard box sitting on the table.
"What's in there?"
he asked. "It's my court records," Wilson said.
"Just paperwork," Jack said.
Link stuck a hand in the box and moved some files around,
and in a few seconds the search was over and he stepped out of the room. Wilson slid a paper across the desk and said, "This is the affidavit. Wire the money to the bank in Panama, then get me written verification so I'll have something to show them. Less 10%. Yes, that's what they think." The Geneva Trust Bank in Nassau had not been contacted. To do so would have been futile and risky. No bank would release funds under the circumstances Argro was creating. And questions would be raised if he tried. The wire transfer going to Panama was new money. "Langley is quite anxious," the lawyer said. "I'm ahead of schedule," the banker replied. The box was emptied on a table in the law library. Beach and Yarber began sifting through its contents, while Argro, their new client, watched with feigned interest. Spicer had better things to do. He was in the middle of his weekly poker game. "Where's the sentencing report?" Beach asked, scratching through the pile. "I want to see the indictment," Yarber mumbled to himself. They found what they wanted and both settled into their chairs for a long afternoon of reading. Beach's choice was quite dull. Yarber's, however, was not. The indictment read like a crime narrative. Argro, along with 7 other bankers, 5 accountants, 5 securities brokers, 2 lawyers, 11 men identified only as drug traffickers, and 6 gentlemen from Colombia, had organized and run an elaborate enterprise designed to take drug proceeds in the form of cash and turn them into respectable deposits. At least $400 million had been laundered before the ring was infiltrated, and it appeared as though their man Argro was right in the thick of things. Yarber admired him. If half the allegations were true, then Argro was a very smart and talented financier. Argro became bored with the silence and left to stroll around the prison. When Yarber finished reading the indictment, he interrupted Beach and made him read it. Beach enjoyed it too. "Surely," he said, "he's got some of the loot buried somewhere." "You know he does," Yarber agreed. $400 million, and that's just what they could find." "What about his appeal?" "Doesn't look good. The judge followed the guidelines. I see no error." "Poor guy." "Poor guy, my ass. He'll be out 4 years before me." "I don't think so, Mr. Beach. We've spent our last Christmas in prison." "Do you really believe that?" Hatley asked. "Indeed I do." Beach placed the indictment back on the table, then stood and stretched and paced around the room. "We should have heard something by now," he said, very softly, though no one else was there. "Patience." "But the primaries are almost over. He's back in Washington most of the time. He's had the letter for a week." "He can't ignore it, Hatley. He's trying to figure out what to do, that's all." The latest memo from the Bureau of Prisons in Washington baffled the warden. Who in hell's name up there had nothing better to do than to stare at a map of the federal prisons and decide which one to meddle with that day? He had a brother making $150,000 selling used cars, and there he was making half that much running a prison and reading idiotic memos from pencil pushers making $100,000 and not doing a productive damned thing. He was so sick of it. Re-Attorney Visitation, Trumbull Federal Prison. Disregard prior order, said order restricting attorney visitation to Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays from 3 to 6 p.m. Attorneys are now permitted to visit 7 days a week from 9 to 7 p.m. "It takes a dead lawyer to get the rules changed," he mumbled to himself. Chapter 35. Deep in a basement garage, they rolled Teddy Maynard into his van and locked the doors. York and DeVille sat with him. A driver and a bodyguard handled the van, which had a television, a stereo, and a small bar with bottled water and sodas, all of which were ignored by Teddy. He was subdued and dreading the next hour. He was tired. Tired of his work, tired of the fight, tired of forcing himself through another day, then another. Fight it 6 more months, he kept telling himself, then give it up and let someone else worry about saving the world.
He'd go quietly to his small farm in West Virginia, where he'd sit by the pond, watch the leaves fall into the water, and wait for the end. He was so tired of the pain. There was a black car in front of them and a gray one behind, and the little convoy made its way around the Beltway, then east across the Roosevelt Bridge and onto Constitution Avenue. Teddy was silent, so therefore York and DeVille were too. They knew how much he loathed what he was about to do. He talked to the president once a week, usually on Wednesday morning, always by phone if Teddy had his way. They last saw each other 9 months earlier when Teddy was in the hospital and the president needed to be briefed. The favors usually fell to an equal level, but Teddy hated to be on the same footing with any president. He'd get the favor he wanted, but it was the asking that humiliated him. In 30 years, he'd survived 6 presidents, and his secret weapon had been the favors. Gather the intelligence, hoard it, rarely tell the president everything, and occasionally gift-wrap a small miracle and deliver it to the White House. This president was still pouting over the humiliating defeat of a nuclear test ban treaty Teddy had helped sabotage. The day before the Senate killed it, the CIA leaked a classified report raising legitimate concerns about the treaty, and the president got flattened in the stampede. He was leaving office, a lame duck, more concerned with his legacy than with the pressing matters of the country. Teddy had dealt with lame ducks before, and they were impossible. Since they wouldn't face the voters again, they dwelt on the big picture. In their waning days, they liked to travel with lots of their friends to foreign lands where they held summits with other lame ducks. They worried about their presidential libraries and their portraits and their biographies, so they spent time with historians. As the clock ticked, they became wiser and more philosophical, and their speeches became grander. They talked of the future, of the challenges and the way things ought to be, conveniently ignoring the fact that they'd had 8 years to do all the things that needed to be done. There was nothing worse than a lame duck. And Lake would be just as bad if and when he had the chance. Lake, the very reason Teddy was trekking to the White House, hat in hand, to grovel for a while. They were cleared through the West Wing, where Teddy suffered the indignity of having his wheelchair examined by a Secret Service agent. Then they rolled him to a small office next to the cabinet room. A busy appointment secretary explained with no apology that the president was running late. Teddy smiled and waved her off and mumbled something to the effect that this president had never been on time for anything. He'd suffered 12 fussy secretaries just like her in the same position she was now in, and the others were long gone. She led York and DeVille and the others away, down to the dining room where they would eat by themselves. Teddy waited, as he knew he would. He read a thick report as if time meant nothing. 10 minutes passed. They brought him coffee. 2 years ago, the president had visited Langley, and Teddy had made him wait for 21 minutes. He needed a favor then, the president did, needed a little matter kept quiet. The only advantage to being crippled was that he didn't have to jump to his feet when the president entered the room. He finally arrived in a rush, with aides scrambling behind him as if this would impress Teddy Maynard. They shook hands and made the required greetings, as the aides got rid of themselves. A waiter appeared and placed small green salads before them. "It's good to see you," the president said with a soft voice and drippy smile. Save it for television, Teddy thought, and he couldn't bring himself to return the lie. "You're looking well," he said, only because it was partially true. The president had a new tint to his hair, and he looked younger. They ate their salads, and a quietness settled around them. Neither wanted a long lunch. "The French are selling toys to the North Koreans again," Teddy said, offering a crumb. "What kind of toys?" the president asked.
though he knew precisely about the trafficking, and Teddy knew he knew. It's their version of stealth radar, which is quite stupid because they haven't perfected it yet. But the North Koreans are even dumber because they're paying for it.
This book is continued on Disc 10.